supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Dayton today at 1. Temple meets Richmond at 3:30 today. And on the women's side, the Colonial Athletic Association quarterfinals. Delaware faces UNC Wilmington at 2:30. You're listening to WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it's a question we've been hit with a lot this winter. What should we do when our trees are hit with winter? Some of them get their roots ripped right out of the ground. Some of them have their tops sheared off by horrific winds. And some trees get split down the center. We'll tell you what to do when winter threatens your arboriculture. But mostly it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heap and helping at 1-888-346-9499. Diana, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you, and thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Diana. Where are you?
I am in lovely Hillpatcong, New Jersey.
Where the heck is that in New Jersey?
In Sussex County, which is the northwest corner.
The northwest corner of New Jersey, the part that most people don't even know exists, right?
That's right.
What can we do for Diana in northwest New Jersey?
I have a question concerning seeds.
Okay.
I order seeds every year, and I do it in January. I'm usually standing there poised on January 2nd, eagerly looking through all the catalogs and ordering seeds.
Very
good. And they, as a result, they come early.
Mm-hmm.
They come a lot earlier than I would plant them. Around here, the average last frost date is mid-May.
Right.
So my question is, how do I store them so that they do not lose viability between the time I receive them and the time I want to start planting them either indoors to start seedlings or to sow outside immediately?
All of the seeds that are sold from January 1st onward, if you notice somewhere on the seed pack, it's going to have a date. It'll say packed for 2011. That's what it'll say this year. And
right.
All of these seeds were collected last year. They were dried, they were stored, and then they were packaged up for sale to you. And the secret to seed storage is the same no matter whether you want to keep the seeds for your 3 months or even 10, sometimes 15 years if you have the exact right conditions. And it is real simple. The room that you store them in, the temperature of the room and the humidity of the room should add up to a number that is less than 100. So typically this is not a huge problem in winter time when the indoor humidity can often be down at, say, 40%, maybe even below. And then if the room temperature is kind of on the cool side, like 60 degrees, you've got the ideal seed storage conditions. The enemies of seeds are heat and moisture.
I get very enthusiastic, and I tend to order more seeds than I can plant in my area. So I want to be able to keep the extras over the winter, and hopefully they're still viable the following year. And I've had very bad luck in the past, and I think I realize now that you say it, why? Because of where I've been storing them, it probably gets up to well over 100 combined humidity and temperature in that room in the summer.
Well, I'll teach you a great little trick you can use to test your seeds for this season. Take each seed packet that you have that you hope to be able to use this year. Take like 10 seeds out of each one. Put the seeds in damp paper towels. Put the damp paper towels inside plastic Ziploc bags, but don't zip them. Just fold them closed and leave them in a warm room, not on top of any kind of radiator or heat source, just a nice warm room. Date the bags and begin checking them after 5 days. if you get 50% or better germination within the first 10 days, those seeds are worth using again. If you get nothing, even though you've kept the paper towel slightly moist, then just compost the seeds. And in the future, as we go forward, get a simple hydrometer temperature gauge and use it to actually test the various rooms of your house. You may get a big surprise. And when you get to the driest, coolest room for long-term storage, put the seeds into sealed glass jars and save up all those little desiccating pouches that you get from vitamin bottles in shoes that absorb moisture. And put a couple of those in every jar. I've kept tomato seeds that way for 10 and 15 years.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you very much. That's been extremely helpful.
Well, it's a great question. You probably saved a lot of people a lot of money just now.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Diana. Take care.
Okay, bye.
1-888-346-9499. Lisa, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being had. Lisa, where are you?
I'm in Media, Pennsylvania.
Right, just outside of Philadelphia. Very good. What can we do you for?
We just moved here last July. I have two little boys who are now 7 and 5 and a 5-month-old baby. And we bought a house in the woods with a lovely stream coming through it. And we're having a real hard time with ticks. We have about an acre. And we've already had to find another house for our cat because he was just bringing them in, even though we had put Frontline on him. The property doesn't really lend itself to a fence, and I really don't want to spray, but even last week the dog was just running around a little bit on the warmer day, and he had one on him within 5 minutes.
And do I hear the baby in the background?
Yes, he's here with me.
Right, so you got your hands full. Ticks
yeah.
are a major issue. I have outdoor cats. I've been very lucky. I do use the Frontline and Advantage products, and so far they've proven to be very effective. But if you even read the box, nothing claims to be as effective against ticks as it is against fleas. And typically, you mentioned putting up a fence. That's not going to help you.
Okay.
I know everybody calls the ones that they fear the most, the little ticks, they call them deer ticks. But in truth, most of these ticks come off of field mice, which you clearly have in abundance. Now, you said you got rid of your cat. Was this an outdoor cat?
He wanted to be indoor-outdoor, and I guess what we learned was the Frontline kills him once they bite him, but he could still walk in with 5 or 6 ticks on him and then wanted to crawl into bed with the kid.
Okay, so the first thing I want to recommend is a product. They're called Daminex Tick Tubes.
I saw those on your website, yeah.
The Daminex tick tubes work great. It's what I rely upon because I'm in a heavily wooded area. I've got two cats patrolling, but there's still lots of field mice. There's herds of deer. And these are simple cardboard tubes that are filled with cotton balls soaked in permethrin, which is a synthetic pesticide, but it's a synthetic version of a botanical pesticide made from chrysanthemum flowers. What I like about it is it's never sprayed. It never enters the environment. It stays on the cotton balls. The mice, who love to build nests out of cotton and cloth and paper, find these tubes scattered around your property. They take the cotton ball back to the nest, and the cotton kills all the ticks that come in on those mice all season long. It is phenomenal. You can achieve over a 90% knockdown of the ticks on your property.
How long does it take for that to kick in? Because I'm concerned about, you know, when the kids want to go out in the spring, they love to play in the creek, and I'm a little nervous about having them out there after, you know, the fall and the early spring we've seen so far.
Well, now we're into parenting, because what I want you to do is, obviously, I do want you to get a big box of the tubes. Tell the children not to play with them, because there is pesticide on those cotton balls, and we don't want the
Absolutely.
Children handling them. One of my favorite memories of my children, who are both in college, is the year they were like 6 and 8 years old and they realized at the very back of the property, two streams came together and they would disappear at 9 a.m. every morning. They would come back at 5 o'clock every night, filthy, scratched up, muddy. And when they came in, we did a tick check. First of all, it takes many hours for a tick to wander around on you until it decides where it wants to attach. Even after it's attached, it takes like 12 hours before there's any viral transfer. So, you know, it's just part of country life. If your kids are playing outside, they really need to get a tick check. Now, if you don't mind having some pesticide a little closer to your body, there are tick sprays that are very low-dose permethrin. And you spray these on the children's clothing, not on their skin, like DEET. Treat their clothes outdoors. It lasts for about 2 weeks, even if you wash the clothes. And any tick that comes within a few inches of your child will be dead before it can actually get on the child.
Okay. Is there anything I can do as we landscape to kind of dissuade or discourage the ticks?
Absolutely. Let air in, let sunlight in, cut back, brush, keep using the tick tubes. And if it eventually gets to a point where this works with your lifestyle, get a flock of guinea hens. Their favorite food is ticks. And of all people, Christy Brinkley, when she moved out to Long Island and found out her area was tick infested, read about this and tried it. And she was actually able to show the USDA that a flock of guinea hens was keeping her property absolutely tick free. All right. Good luck, Lise.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and start looking for that perfect day to plant some of my early runs of lettuce outdoors. I started the plants inside. I've been taking them out for short trips on nice days. And now I'm just waiting for when I can move that dirt around easily with my little fingers and pronounce the soil unfrozen enough to receive the roots of these cool weather lovers. But don't you go testing the waters in your raised beds just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and what to do when winter whacks your trees. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible with support from Seed Savers Exchange, whose 2011 Heirloom Seed Catalog, offering nearly 600 varieties, is now available. Learn more at seedsavers.org.
There's more of You Bet Your Garden in just a moment on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Rutgers School of Business at Camden introduces a new professional Master of Accountancy program. This 16-month accelerated program is for working professionals interested in earning a Master of Accountancy without disrupting their full-time career. Classes will be held two evenings a week at the Camden County Boathouse in Pensauken. Rutgers will host an information session at 6 p.m. Monday, March 21st. 856-225-2700 or business.camden.rutgers.edu/PMAC.
Don't let Congress save a buck today at tomorrow's expense. I'm WHYY CEO Bill Morazzo. Visit WHYY.org to become one of the 170 million Americans who support public media.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, what should your response be when a giant tree is uprooted by mean winter or even summer winds? What should your response be when the top of a tree gets harmed by winter ice and snow, or when a tree is split? We'll tell you what to do with all of those problems when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, though, it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, so we're taking that heap and helping of your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. at 1-888-346-9499. Rick, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, hi, thanks. Thanks for talking to me.
Well, thank you for talking to me, Rick. Where are you, man?
Well, I'm in Kettering, Ohio.
And where is Kettering?
Kettering is a suburb of Dayton, Ohio.
Oh, okay, very good. What can we do for you, Rick?
Well, two winters, not this winter that we're in right now, but last winter, I cleverly poisoned my garden. I remembered as a kid that my mother used to sometimes put fireplace ashes out in the garden. And I think we were in an area with very acid soil. But anyway, her gardens never were very good either. So I put at least one cord of wood worth of fireplace ashes.
Ooh, that's a lot.
I've got two 6x12 raised bed gardens, and I very carefully divided it between them so that I wouldn't short one of them. And last year, my garden was terrible, and I blamed it on all kinds of different things. And then earlier this year, I heard you talking to a caller about warning him not to do that. And I got to thinking, and I figured, that's not something I should do. And I was planning on going out and getting a bunch of locally they give away 2 or 3 year old wood chippings that have been decomposing for 2 or 3 years, and that, well, I'll just stir a few inches of that in. But I'm looking for your advice.
Oh, good. So we haven't done that yet.
No, we haven't done that yet.
Now, when you say they have wood chips that are, you know, kind of decomposed, do you see any wood chips in this pile, or does it look like a pile of black soil?
You can find some wood chips, but it's the majority of it is soil.
If I were you, and if I really wanted to use this material, I would bring it home and let it compost down for another year until I was sure there wasn't any loose carbon floating around in there. Because tilling wood into your soil would have the same effect as tilling the ashes into your soil. Did you have a lot of moisture over the winter?
We did. It was a very wet winter.
I would suggest you, that's a good sign, by the way, but I do know that in dry climates you typically have alkaline soil, in wet climates you typically have soil that's a little bit on the acidic side. So I would want to go out and I would want to, you know, have a couple of areas of your garden tested. You say you're in Ohio. I believe Ohio has a great inexpensive soil test program through their extension service. So I would send a sample off if that's the case, and obviously the thing you're looking for mostly is the pH. You can also get a pH meter that you can jab into your garden at various locations. So let's see what we got. It's possible that your soil has crept back towards neutral. If it's 7 or below 7, I would say that the danger is over, everything has fixed itself. Nature is great at healing these kind of wounds, and you can just proceed. If it is 7 or over, then what I would suggest, even though I often don't suggest tilling anything into a raised bed garden, in this case, I would get a big bale of milled peat moss and till some of that into your garden. Here's the advantage of having your own test strips or your own meter, because you can let it settle out for like a week, and then you can retest it. You should be able to work enough peat into your soil to bring it down to between 6.5 and a pH of 7, which is the ideal range for garden plants. The peat moss is very inexpensive. It's all natural, and it'll actually loosen up a little bit of your clay soil as you till it in. So I think this is totally curable.
Let's see if I've shot myself in the foot again. I've been dumping coffee grounds out there.
Well, coffee grounds are acidic.
That was my rationale.
Why don't you till it all up, get it tested, and see where you are. But if you do need to remediate any more, just the peat for now, because the coffee grounds are so nitrogen-rich, you will eventually start to impede the flowering on your plants, which would mean fewer tomatoes. It sounds like you might be pretty close to the goal here. Get it tested, and then if you need to move it a little bit more, just a little bit of peat moss. If it's even down between 6 and 6.5, don't worry about it. Just add some compost and have a great garden.
Outstanding. Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, man.
Thanks.
1-888-346-9499. Sybil, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing good, Sybil. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm in Prattville, Alabama.
Very good. And what can we do for Sybil in Prattville?
Well, I went to school at Auburn University, and I'm 71 now, so when I was there, it was still Alabama Polytechnic Institute. I was a music major at the time, but I know some of the students who are going now, and all of those students and us Auburn fans and former students are really concerned about the trees at Toomer's Corners, the poison trees. And I was just listening to you last Saturday and wondered if you might could give us some hope about perhaps saving those trees.
Well, it's funny you mention this because a lot of people brought it to my attention. Apparently somebody from a rival school poured large amounts of a very powerful herbicide into the root zone of these magnificent old trees, like over 100 years old, right,
Sybil? I think
Sybil?
About 130.
And luckily, this idiot then called up a radio talk show and bragged about it.
Yeah.
And announced that he had done it, and they caught him.
Yes.
Now, I will tell you, I was just delighted to be contacted by some people at the Agricultural Extension office that's trying to work on this. And they emailed me pretty early in the game to tell me what they were doing and to pick my brain. A couple of things that I told them that immediately came to mind is I know they removed some of the soil. I hope they didn't go too deep. I hope they didn't disturb the root zone of the tree too much, trying to get some of the poisoned soil out. And then they were trying to prevent water from getting to the roots of the tree, which I presume has to do, probably this is an herbicide that is carried into the root zone via the water-absorbing capacity of the roots. But I told them I didn't care about that. My plan would be to, you know, essentially irrigate the roots of those trees 24/7 for about a month. To really try to dilute the chemical, to dilute the amount that the trees were taking up at any given time, rather than them getting a big dose when they come out of dormancy, to have really make sure anything they absorb is a minute concentration of what was put in there, to keep irrigating it. And I thought that there are probably a couple of beneficial bacteria. I don't know if it would be the mycorrhizal bacteria that are naturally soil occurring that convey a lot of stress resistance to plants. But I thought really inoculating the soil with beneficial bacteria would not harm the plants and could help them. In addition, kelp and seaweed foliar feeds are very good at helping plants resist stress. So that is the kind of triple-edged attack I would take. Try to flush as much of this herbicide out. Try to put some beneficial bacteria in that soil that would denature the herbicide and strengthen the overall cellular health of the trees with seaweed and kelp. I would not give it any other kind of a heavy feeding. And then one thing that I think has to be taken into account, this is a horrible tragedy, and I hope the trees can be saved, but the timing of what's going on here is such that this is the time to take cuttings of these trees. There's a gentleman I had on the show probably 8-10 years ago who had written a book on America's historic trees, and these were like the tree that grew outside of Amelia Earhart's bedroom while she made paper airplanes, a tree that the surrender of the South took place under, a tree that Abraham Lincoln used for shade during a famous speech. I think Elvis's pin oak was one of these trees. And what he and his colleagues had done is travel to these historic trees and carefully take cuttings and root them and then propagate them in a nursery, I believe, down south, maybe even in Florida, and then make these trees available. Because if you take a cutting from one of these trees and get it to root and get it to grow, it is the tree. So if the worst happens, what I would hope is going to happen is people would be taking every possible type of cutting, any new growth, even the old growth. They can even clone cells from these trees, and they can grow the same tree. Now, you're not going to get that kind of stature or stateliness again right away from a young tree. But should the worst happen, should these trees fall, should they be totally killed, then I think the only possible response would be to carefully remove them, take the trees themselves and make something out of them. There's another gentleman who contacted me just about a year ago, and I've lost all his contact information, and I hope he'll hear this and get back in touch with me. But he goes to historic sites where trees have been damaged, and he takes the wood and he crafts these beautiful pens from the woods of these historic trees. So if the trees fall, I would hope that their wood can be shaped into some sort of pens or canes or something that every alumni could then buy and use as a memory of this tree, and the funds from that go to getting every bit of soil out of there, replacing it with good soil, and replanting it with a grove of these trees taken from the same cellular structure of the trees that were poisoned. It would be really the only way to show this creep that you may do some temporary damage, but 100 years from now, your name will still be cursed, but we'll have these big, beautiful, leafy trees in the same spot, and they will be the same trees, and you will have lost, sir.
Well, thank you so much, Mike. Those were wonderful, beautiful suggestions, and I think it's a good way for us to try to save the trees or to get the next ones going for us.
Exactly. And we're all pulling for you, all our listeners.
Thank you so much.
All right. You take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thanks for taking the call, Mike.
Well, thank you.
We're over in the Maritime Pacific Northwest in Vancouver, Washington.
Oh, okay. Very good. Very good. What can we do for John up in Washington State?
I got permission to use some property behind me that's neglected and had all was covered in Himalayan blackberries. I'm going to use that for my vining crops so I can get those out of my tomato garden. And so I've gone in and cut down the blackberries and chipped them. And I need to know what to do with all of those chips. I put them all in trash cans right now.
Well, you could have left them sitting out in the open. Now, you say that where the blackberries were growing, you're going to put in a vegetable garden?
Yeah, I'm going to put zucchini and try a watermelon and probably a pumpkin.
How are you going to keep the blackberries from regrowing from their underground roots?
Initially, I'm going to cover the area with cardboard.
Okay, very good.
And then build mounds of a compost mix, a leaf mold type mix, for the plants, the vegetable plants to grow in.
Okay, good. So you're going to level the surface back there, you're going to cover it with cardboard, and then you're going to build raised beds on top.
Correct.
Okay.
No sides on the beds, just the hills.
You don't have to. I mean, in the French intensive system, the raised beds are never framed, and they use the mounded sides to grow small flowers and greens and herbs. You know, theoretically, because it gives you 20% more growing space, but it also looks really cool, and it stabilizes the sides of the beds as well as frames or stone wood. So I would suggest that you stick to the raised bed principle and make your mounds no wider than 4 feet so you're not stepping into them, so you'll never have to till them up again. You can just add fresh compost to the top every year. And then your 2-foot-wide walking lanes where you don't want anything to grow, you cover that a couple inches deep in your wood mulch, which is essentially what the blackberry canes are, is a wood mulch when you get right down to it.
My wife was concerned about the thorns in the blackberries. I told her that should be inconsequential.
Well, you know, you're not going to be walking on them barefoot, I would hope.
No.
And you were able to actually chip them all down, right? Did you run them through a big chipper shredder?
Yeah, I ran them through a chipper shredder, and they're all quarter-inch square now.
you might have to actually take a good look at that. You might have to just go over the mulch with a hoe to make sure you don't have kind of a nail sticking up out of the road, if you know what I mean.
Okay.
But I think it's too good a natural material not to use, and it's right there. You do need a good weed-suppressing mulch in the lanes, or, you know, you just live in the Garden of Eden because of your climate and the moisture. The plants just can easily take over where you are. You don't need me to tell you that.
No, it's, they certainly can. I have my share of menaces out there.
Yeah, well, it's a great place to be a plant, John.
You are the most organic person I listen to on the radio, so yeah, I appreciate that.
It might not be a tough contest, though. All right, well, thank you, John. Good luck with your plan. I like it a lot.
All right, thank you, Mike.
Take care.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and decide which packet of snow peas is going to be pre-sprouted indoors next week so that I can have some seeds ready to go into my sunniest ground on St. Patrick's Day. Because while the plants will grow nicely in cool weather, unsprouted seeds would just sit there and sulk. Let's see. Choices. Should it be Super Snappy, Snowbird, Oregon Giant, maybe Oregon Sugar Pod 2, the sequel? Makes you wonder whatever happened to Oregon Sugar Pod 1, doesn't it? Huh. Well, just don't you go playing eeny, peeny, miny, moe just yet. Because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and what to do when winter whacks your trees. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible with support from Seed Savers Exchange, whose 2011 Heirloom Seed Catalog, offering nearly 600 varieties, is now available. Learn more at seedsavers.org.
It's 11:38, 53 degrees in Center City.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. Today and tomorrow are your last chances to visit or revisit this year's fabulous Philadelphia Flower Show at the Pennsylvania Convention Center. On Sunday, March 20th, I'll get you ready for a pest and weed-free season without chemicals when I reveal the 7 secrets of successful organic gardeners at the Buck's Beautiful Garden Show at Delaware Valley College in Doylestown. That's next Saturday, March 20th. My talk starts at 1 p.m. And on Saturday, April 2nd, I'll deliver the keynote and get your lawn off drugs at the Green Gardening Workshop and Native Plant Sale at the Lower Macungie Community Center in the beautiful Lehigh Valley. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
On today's Fresh Air Weekend, award-winning chef Grant Achatz. He'll talk about making avant-garde dishes like olive oil lollipops and root beer float cubes during a period when he could barely eat anything because he was being treated for tongue cancer. Also, former spies Robert and Dana Bear talk about falling in love while working for the CIA. Fresh Air Weekend comes your way at 1 today here on WHYY. The forecast, mix of sun and clouds today, the high about 58, tomorrow mostly sunny, the high 55. Right now it's 53 degrees.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll be getting to one of this winter's most frequently asked questions. What should I do when bad weather uproots a favorite tree of mine, snaps the top off, or splits the poor tree in half? We'll answer all those difficult questions after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Mary Agnes, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you.
It's a pleasure to speak with you. May I ask where you are?
I'm in Salisbury, Maryland, actually the suburbs, a town called Allen,
on
the Eastern Shore.
I know Salisbury, Maryland very well. I know the Eastern Shore very well. What can we do for Mary Agnes just outside of beautiful Salisbury, Maryland?
Well, I've got hydrangeas, and they're 2 years old. They're in the ground 2 years, and I've never pruned them.
Oh, I love you.
Why?
Because you've done the right thing.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, because my neighbor, she pruned hers, and then now I, all winter long, I'm thinking, I didn't do it. So now I feel so guilty that I didn't do it.
Oh, you could call her names if you wanted.
No, she's a great lady.
Here's the deal. We once had a guy on the show, because I was confused about the pruning of hydrangeas, and everyone assured me he was the world's leading expert on the pruning of hydrangeas. First thing he says is, I know nothing about the pruning of hydrangeas. Nobody does. He says they're mysterious plants. They're supposed to only bloom on old wood, which means that they would typically only produce their flowers on what was left from the previous year. But he said one day a kid went wild with a lawnmower and ran over a whole field of hydrangeas, and he figured, oh, great, you know, and this is a test bed. We're not going. And he said they got flowers. So he said obviously nobody had told the stupid hydrangeas what they were supposed to do. So here's the deal. I worked this out with him. We came to the conclusion that this is a brilliant idea. We're sharing all the money we make from it.
Oh, good.
Because hydrangeas are so unusual in their blooming habit, what you should do is leave them alone in the fall, especially. You know, they leave those. If you don't take the flowers off,
didn't take them off. They're
good.
Sitting on there.
Birds love that seed. This has been a great food resource for birds over this past winter. When the new growth appears from the bottom of the plant, the new green growth, then you may carefully clip off the old spent flower heads and anything on the tip that you don't like, but don't really prune yet. Let the plants grow out all spring. As you know, these are summer bloomers typically.
Right.
Late spring, early summer, they start to put their flowers on. When they produce their flowers, give them some time for the flowers to form. Then, when it's quite clear where there's going to be a flower and where there isn't, you know, we're probably talking about June, July. Get in there with pruners and remove entire canes that are not flowering, but that are blocking the flowers from view. So this way you can't make a mistake. But then, to avoid having a big bushy plant where the flowers are all hidden in the middle, once the flowers are formed and coloring up, it makes perfect sense to go in and thin it out. So then, you look like you got twice as many flowers.
Right.
And you avoided making any kind of a mistake and just follow that same sequence every year. And you know, are yours the regular red-blue type?
Yes.
Okay, so you know that if your soil's neutral, you'll get pinkish-red flowers, and if you acidify it, the flowers will turn blue. I will tell you a trick I do every year is that when I want to get funky, I spread peat moss either around the front or the back or just around one of the three shrubs in a row.
Uh-huh.
And that way I get blue flowers on the front and red flowers on the back, or I get a red-blue-red combination, and it drives people crazy. These things respond to the soil acidity and milled peat moss very quickly, and you can play all kind of tricks with the things.
Oh, isn't that's cool. How about fertilizing? That's the other thing.
All I've ever done is give them a shovel full of compost every once in a while.
And that's it.
Yeah, they don't need it.
The compost is the ideal thing.
Oh, yeah. You think about it. These plants have been around for millennia. This trash in a bag that, you know, whose other use is in explosive shells, has only been around for, you know, 50, 100 years. The plants did fine without it.
That's true.
You know, you live in such a fragile, beautiful ecological area. I mean, you got the bay on one side, you got the ocean on the other, you've got all these canals, all this beautiful scrub pine around you. You live in a very ecologically sensitive area. Why would you add chemicals to your soil?
You are right. You are right. And well, see, you know, I don't know. I'm a novice at this. So I thank you so much. And I have to tell you, I really enjoy your show. I've learned so much.
Well, thank you.
All right. You take care and thank you.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Suzanne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Suzanne. How are you?
Pretty good.
And where is Suzanne pretty good?
I'm in Horsham. which is about 15 miles northeast of where you are.
Okay.
If you're in Philly.
I am in Philly at this very moment. All right. Very good. Suze, what can we do for you?
Well, I keep chickens, and I went to a weekend demonstration, whatever, of a restored grist mill where they were milling corn, like, you know, feed corn, and they ended up with a lot of really fine, almost flour-like, and we set up a deal where I would barter eggs, and they would give me this corn because they didn't know what to do with it and didn't want to waste it.
That's interesting.
Well, it was until I learned the hard way that chickens shouldn't be fed much corn. I was loading several sacks the last time I went there of ground corn into my pickup, and a couple of strangers who were standing around said, "Oh, now you have corn gluten." And my question to you is, do I have corn gluten? I don't know what it is. I have a couple of several gardening books, and I can't find corn gluten in the indices to any of them.
No. Corn gluten only came into the horticultural world about 20 years ago when Dr. Nick Christians, a turf grass researcher at Iowa State, was trying to help Iowa get rid of some of the byproducts of the various types of manufacturing they would do utilizing corn. And corn gluten is what is left over after they make corn starch. It's one component. If you've ever seen these commercials for like whole grain breads and stuff where they dissect the kernel of wheat, the germ, the gluten, the fiber, you know, so corn gluten is one component of corn. And it sounds like you are simply getting cornmeal, which to me, I mean, I presume they're using high grade field corn to grind in this demonstration mill. I would imagine it has the potential to make very good cornbread and corn muffins and corn flakes. I mean, it is a very basic human food grain. I have to admit, I am totally unknowledgeable about what you feed chickens. So I don't know about the usefulness of your corn meal, which I'm going to say that what you're getting is corn meal with all of the...
It's just the simple feed corn all ground up with all the parts in there, but nothing else.
Right, so the gluten has not been isolated at all. Now, if it had been through the process of becoming isolated, and don't ask me how they do that, then the corn gluten meal would be a very effective springtime weed and feed for lawns, because what Nick at Iowa State discovered is corn gluten meal prevents the germination of weed seeds.
Okay, that was another. My other question is it a herbicide, and is the other thing you used to recommend to put it on the lawn to discourage grubs from, like, Japanese beetles?
Corn gluten meal is a pre-emergent herbicide. It will not affect existing weeds. It will prevent seeds from germinating for about 8 weeks. I believe the other substance you're talking about is very different. That's milky spore. That's a naturally occurring soil organism that you apply to lawns in the fall. But
okay.
I tell you, your chickens, allowing them free access to the lawn, they'd eat all the grubs in it.
I know that. It's just that right now I can't let them out. But thank you very much. I learned a lot.
All right, Sue. So maybe there's a way to use some of the corn to feed your chicken. You have to talk to a specialist about that. But freshly ground cornmeal with the whole grain is a great human product. And I think you should experiment with cooking with it in some small batches.
I surely will.
All right. Good luck, Sue.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week, how to deal with winter-damaged trees. We begin with Michael in Sterling, Virginia, who writes, "I had a great backyard up until the last two winters. Now my remaining five pines have had their tops snapped off, and all but two of our 22 cedars have been topped or fallen over. Are the pines now doomed? I've hand-winched some of the cedars back to vertical with their root mounds hopefully intact. and I'm climbing what's left of the damaged pines and cedars to smooth cut the broken tops, which seems to be the only reasonable thing to do. I really like the greenness and fragrance of both trees, but I'm losing the battle. Any suggestions? Plenty. But first, I'm wondering if something's wrong here in the big picture. As I was typing this answer in my home office, praying that the power would hold out while wind gusts of 60 miles an hour whipped through our heavily forested landscape, I noted that there were small branches down all over the property, and as usual, the rotten tops of our oldest tulip poplars had dropped some heavy hitters down. Oh, look, there's the thud we heard at 4 a.m. Over the years, a couple of our trees have fallen in the woods. Some have snapped and some have been uprooted, but nothing like your level of damage. So let's review some possible causes. Trees that are planted too deeply, that's no root flare showing above ground, or whose soil is improved in the planting hole to the point that the roots refuse to grow beyond those comfy confines, are often prone to toppling out of the ground. And trees whose bases are wrapped up in, quote, decorative volcano mounds of mulch could easily be induced to snap. You pile mulch up around the bark rots, tree fall down, go boom. In short, proper tree care can sometimes, but not always, prevent these very expensive and dangerous problems. Sometimes you just live in a wind tunnel, which may be your case. Now, on to what you should do, should have done, and should not do. If trees topple over with their roots out of the ground in winter, you don't have to, and should not, try and replant them in frozen soil. Instead, find a supply of unfrozen topsoil or compost and heal the trees in by covering their roots completely. Water the roots of your sideways trees if we have a dry spell. Keep adding soil if the roots get exposed. Then get some help and replant them upright and correctly in early spring. When the soil is unfrozen and they're just waking up from winter dormancy and have a natural urge to regrow. Now, for trees that have lost their tops, do even less. Sure, clean up the ground-level debris, but leave the poor damaged remnants of the trees alone up top. If there's enough tree left up there, it may regrow into a desirable shape, or a shape that can be pruned into desirable after a year or so. Quote, shearing the tops off any tree is always a bad idea. The only thing it can accomplish is more trauma to the tree and perhaps the removal of that special branch that would otherwise take over and begin the process of reformation. Cutting the top off of a tree also typically makes the tree look very ugly for a while, followed by death. And if our listener just can't keep his hands off these poor things until at least spring, I really do have to wonder if he's been compulsively pruning them, mulching their trunks, feeding them chemicals, or otherwise fussing over them to the point of instilling weakness into what should be his strongest plants. But alas, no matter what, a 20-foot-high tree that snapped off 2 feet above the ground is a goner and should be removed. But when many trees are so affected, it's also better to wait until spring. Then you can do an inventory and have the dead removed professionally with all their stumps pulled out of the ground. Then you can replant that area immediately, perhaps with a little better care. Hint, hint. We move on to Bill in Warrington, Virginia, who writes, the recent heavy snow split the trunk of a rather large Japanese red maple I have in my garden. I've read that the split may be repaired by installing a bolt to hold the two halves together and that the tree will eventually heal itself. Is this the best way to repair the tree? How do you know when a split can be repaired? Well, there may be such bolt-only repairs in the world of arboriculture, Bill, but I think you might mean the much more common cabling, where heavy metal cables are run through damaged trees to hold them together. I'm not sure how much actual healing takes place, but the sections of cabled trees I've seen were all still alive when they were worked on, and the cabling was done mostly to prevent the split from getting worse. a highly skilled arborist who has experience with extreme methods of tree preservation is the best person to decide if, one, the tree is worth the expense, and two, the operation stands a good chance of success. And obviously, this is not do-it-yourself work. This is pay somebody who knows how to do it and has the tools work. But, unlike our previous question, where I believe the homeowner might be showing signs of impatience, a split requires an immediate inspection and fast as possible repair. It would not be unusual for a split tree to be easily fixed in January, but to be past repair after the very next ice storm makes the split wider in February. Well, that sure was some good information on what to do when trees get hit hard by winter, now wasn't it? Luckily, yous can read the print version of the question of the week at the Gardens Alive website. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to trim back my top if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Put the actual subject in the subject line. And of course, check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week, find the solutions to hundreds of garden problems, just like yours, hint, hint, in our alphabetized A to Z archive of garden answers, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Kevin, don't call me Merv Griffin. Our webmasters are the unspellable Rich Banowitz and Zaboo's litter changer, Sarah Kazar. Get well soon wishes to our intern, Jessica Mandick, who is down but not out. Taking a standing 8 count is Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our editor, Al Banks, says, if I go down, I stay down. I'm throwing in the towel in the 12th, Mike McGrath, but only because the ring is all sweaty. So I'll see you next week.
Mike carefully and capably helps us to cajole young plants out of the soil, whether they be camellia, corn, radishes, or roses. And speaking of roses, they are the most popular garden flower, despite being susceptible to dread disease. On next week's You Bet Your Garden, Mike McGrath will reveal how and when to prune your roses to give them the best chance at a happy, healthy summer. Plus, Mike will take your fabulous phone calls all at 11 next Saturday morning. And don't forget, You Bet Your Garden is now available as a podcast at our website,